Welcome to Blind Like Me. I'm Phil Parr. We spent an hour with George Wurzel from Lansing, Michigan last week. Hope you heard the show. If you didn't, you can go look in the archives. I think they're keeping those up pretty well, but we hope you heard last week's show. We have a few minutes before we get into our interview for today. So, George, welcome to the second edition of Blind Like Me.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. You have had a most interesting life. We've taken you through Michigan School for the Blind, graduated public school, ran a, you wouldn't call it a wood shop, you'd call it a cabinet shop, I suppose.
Architectural millwork.
Architectural millwork. That's a that's fancy.
Yep.
So we did that for until 1982, went to North Carolina, attempted to get a degree in furniture building, furniture construction, ended up down in North Carolina designing a factory to make European-style cabinets for a guy, quit that job, and decided you made these things I didn't exactly understand that.
It's a triangular-shaped wooden box that when there's a funeral for someone who's been in the military, everybody is eligible to receive a flag over their casket at their burial to honor them for serving our country. And when the funeral is over, they take that flag and they fold it in the normal way that a flag is folded, which is the traditional way that a flag is folded. And when it's done, it ends up being in a triangle. If anybody were in Boy Scouts, you had to learn how to do that.
I remember that, yes.
That has just the stars showing on it when you're done. It's, and it's in the shape of a triangle. And all these people, you know, receive flags if they so desire, or
yes,
or their widows or widowers, whatever it is, so desire. So my father had passed away, and I had been toting his flag around for years and years and years, and my mother always had given me a hard time about why a guy in the woodworking business doesn't build a flag for his dad's, or a box for his dad's flag is beyond her.
Mm-hmm.
And so after I sold quit my job from working at the cabinet company.
Yeah.
I was looking at something to do, so I started building these. And I did some research. I didn't go into this without a lot of thought in the process. I did a lot of research to find out, you know, what the potential market was.
If you could sell them. No point in building if you can't sell them.
That's right. And interestingly enough, you know, anybody who'd been in World War II at that point in time was going to be in their 60s. So if you looked at there was a real nice bell curve that the Veterans Administration produced that showed the rate in which veterans would pass away over the next 10 years or so. And that's actually what the appeal was for the man who bought my flag case company from me, because I showed him that bell curve, and he saw that there was going to be a potential, you know, of 3 million of these things in the next, you know, 5 years, 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
Based on just the fact that when we get old, we happen to die. And
So you started this company.
Yep.
And ran it, but you subcontracted out all the work.
I subcontracted every aspect of it out. And part of the reason that I started my little company was called Sell America. And I wanted to increase my knowledge of how to market, because I thought that no matter what you're going to do in your life, you have to be a good marketer.
That's right.
You can be the best cabinet builder in the world, but if you can't market your product, no one will ever know you do it.
And so you were the office guy. You ran the office.
Yep.
You called the funeral home and said, "Hi, I'm George Wurzel. I have a company that builds these. Could we send you some samples?" Or, you know, you did this.
I bought an IBM 888 computer, which at that point in time cost like $3,000 or $4,000.
A lot of money.
Yes. A lot of money.
Back in the '80s.
Yep. And they all ran on DOS, and you had Vert Plus was the software, that is speech output software that I used, and I sat down and taught myself how to run the software and how to run the computer.
And how to keep, you could keep your customer list and all that.
I did the whole thing in a product that was a software product that was called DBase. It's a database program that would keep track of everything. Did the, you know, keep track of all your customers, your marketing. I went to one of the big list companies and bought a list from Dun & Bradstreet on funeral homes.
On funeral homes and called every one of them.
Yep, and called every one of them.
All right. Now, once again, we're down to time constraint. You said now that this is 2006,
yep.
You were running a camp for blind children. Tell us, give us a little synopsis of that.
Well, I came back to Michigan in the mid-90s, started another company doing Corian countertops and selling kitchen cabinets.
Okay.
And was running that quite successfully until I got hit by a car.
Hit by a car crossing a street?
Actually, just walking down the sidewalk. Wasn't even crossing the street. Guy backing out of his driveway, talking on his cell phone, and it was raining out. And I didn't hear him, and he didn't see me. And did serious damage to both knees and my back.
Mm.
And my whole thing about shops that I've ever been in, with the exception of my little spit doing the selling the flag cases and that, I've always been a shop guy, and I'm just not able to do it anymore. So I've always been involved in this camp in Michigan called Camp Tusmahita, which is for the four senses you have when you don't have sight. It's touch, hear, smell, taste. And they were looking for someone to help run the camp, and I held up my hand and they hired me.
And so that's where you are today.
That's where I am.
Do you live at the camp?
I do during the summertime. The camp is like 60 miles from my house.
Now, this is for blind children.
For blind children.
And do we teach them anything or just let them row boats? Or what are they?
We are very committed to teaching, but we give no tests. But there is a document that's called the Expanded Core Curriculum, and it outlines all of the skills that a blind person should acquire through their K-12 education process.
Mm-hmm.
And we have taken several areas of that, daily living skills, personal management skills, sports and recreation skills, and industrial arts skills, and incorporated them into what we're doing at the camp. Our camp is, you know, we really work on making blind people independent at our camp.
How many children do you have?
Last summer we served about 120 campers.
And this is for boys and girls, or
boys
just boys?
And girls.
Boys and girls.
And we break it up into 10 different sessions during the course of the summer. We always have an environmental program of some sort.
Yeah.
We always have a music program. We always have an art program.
Now, do they pay for this, or do you get...
A nominal amount of money, $200 per session.
$200 per session. Is that covered? Do you got grants?
No.
Nope.
Last year, it cost us per child about $1,000 per kid per session.
So you have to look for money.
So we go out and raise the money to
run the camp. All right, sir. Unfortunately, we're out of time again.
Yep.
You've had a most interesting life. I can't imagine you being, if you'd been able to see, I can't imagine you doing any more.
Yeah, well,
I've
done exactly what I've wanted to do all my life. I've let myself be pushed into some corner, being a, you know, running a vending operation or a piano tuner or chair caner or broom salesman or...
Because that wasn't what you wanted to do, so you didn't do that.
That's right. I've always done and been stubborn about it.
You're in your mid-50s, right?
Yep, I am indeed.
I want to talk to you more about the camp, but unfortunately, George Wurzel, we're out of time. Thank you very much, sir. It's been a most interesting interview.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Do you know about the Blind Handyman List, sir?
The thing I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place. Exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I have found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the handyman list, and it worked.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman list, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman list, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. A trip to Walmart.
I wonder where the pharmacy is. It's somewhere over here. Oh, God, I've got my can caught in something.
Pardon me, sir. don't know how to tell you this, but the end of your cane is stuck in my...
Why bother shopping the big discount stores when you can shop from the comfort of your own home at BlindMySmart.com?
Hi, this is Dale Campbell, president of Blind My Smart. If you can't find what you're looking for today, check back tomorrow. We're adding new products every day.
Blind My Smart, with thousands of products at a completely accessible website. Our address is BlindMySmart.com. Again, that's www.BlindMySmart.com.
Making plans, that's my dream. Love is ours every day.
Hello there, welcome to another Blind Like Me. We're recording on the 30th of April of 2006, a beautiful sunny day in the piney woods of East Texas. I'm Phil Parr, as you know, and our guest is Richard Chatman from, I guess, from Boston, right?
Yeah, actually from Jamaica Plain, which is part of the city of Boston. It's a very kind of mixed melting pot, if you will, of population, but it's a... It's a very beautiful area of Boston, and it's about 55 degrees here in Boston.
Well, that's not bad. Sunshining, I suppose.
It's sunshining.
Little spring. And you in Boston, you folks in Boston are lucky enough to actually have four seasons.
Well, I'll tell you what. We've had snow in May, too, so we've had all four seasons in the month of May.
Well, this is rather unusual. Texas, we were down to 54, I think, when I got up at 5:30 this morning. And that's kind of unusual. Usually, by now, it's hot in Texas.
Yeah, it's true.
We're having a beautiful day. What is your level of vision, your total, right?
That's correct.
And you were born that way.
That's correct.
I think you said in 1944.
Yeah, my birthday is a week from Tuesday.
So you will be 63.
I'll be the big 62.
62.
Yep, I'm proud of it, too.
That's good. You seem to be doing all right for a 62-year-old.
Trying my best. I'm very lucky to be, you know, pretty much healthy.
Yeah, that's
knock
good.
On wood.
No heart, no real physical problems of any kind.
No.
Well, you are lucky. I tell
I
you that.
Lucky.
If you don't take blood pressure pills by this time in your life, you're damn.
I tell
lucky.
You what, I do take them, but we're keeping it, you know, pretty much under wraps, keeping it under control. I do a lot of running. We have a treadmill in the building where I live, and I work out on it 3 or 4 times a week. But one of the things, Phil, that I have to confess that I'm having the hardest trouble with is dieting.
Uh-huh.
Old habits die hard.
They do, and you're a hamburger lover, a fried food lover, or what?
I'm more of a hamburger lover and a pastry lover, although now I've developed a dislike for donuts. I'll eat a cookie and a piece of love cake, but I won't eat a donut. I'm weird that way.
I could eat a dozen glazed if I could. I mean,
I used to love coconut.
I just like plain glazed donuts. I'm down to where I eat maybe two now because I feel you feel guilty about doing much more the way things are now.
True,
of course,
true.
We all know people who have eaten that kind of bad all their lives and are 90 and 100.
Yeah.
So you were born during the war, during World War II. The war was still going on. And you say you were born in Florida, did you
That's
say?
That's correct. Avon Park, Florida. And don't ask me where it is. I've been trying to find out where it is. My dad was a lieutenant in the Army Air Force. And if I had not been born a blind person, I'm very convinced my dad would have run an insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
I really am, because he was in sales all his life. You know, in the 1930s, no depression food line for him. He was out selling. First, it started with newspapers, and he had a milk run, then magazines, and he was selling shoes and magazines while going to school part time when World War II broke out.
Now, you were when you started rolling tape here, you were in the middle of a story about your father who had served in the military.
That's correct. As I say, he would have been, you know, a businessman. But what happened, it was very touch and go with me, Phil, and he was told by people in the hospital that I would be, I'd be blind and that I would be a vegetable. My dad once told me, which, of course, I didn't know this, but I did have some exploratory surgery at the age of 6 months. But he went back to his Army Air Force buddies, and the way the story goes, he said, when this war is over, I swear I'm going to go home, and I'm going to find out what made my kid blind.
What a deal.
And he became an ophthalmologist because of me. And I'll tell you, Phil, and to all your listeners out there, I'm very proud of that. Very proud of that.
You should be. That's quite a thing. And so he probably already had a degree in something.
No, he was part-time, had been part-time at Boston University in business, I guess, before the war broke out. He left it, volunteered to enlist.
Mm-hmm.
They commissioned him in the Army Air Force as an officer, which they never did to people who were, didn't have a college degree, apparently.
Yeah, that's what
And he was honorably discharged in 45 as a lieutenant. He was a navigator in the Mitchell B-29 bombers.
Yeah. And he said, I'm going to go home and find out why my kid's blind. And he came home and went back to school.
He did. Full-time Harvard pre-med and in ophthalmology, Boston University Medical School.
So that's how you ended up in the Boston area.
My dad was a native of the Boston area. He was in native of North Quincy, Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
where I feel my roots are. And he was in, and he lived in Quincy. His practice started in Quincy, and he branched out to another suburban town of Boston called Dedham. And then he moved to Milton, which is sort of southeast of Boston, about 10 miles. And he retired in 1988, about 33 years after he started. His practice opened September 1st, 1955.
But actually, your blindness was due to prematurity.
That's correct.
He did not know that at the time, or he didn't...
Well, they figured that because I was premature, I think they did alert him that there would be a risk, and, you know, with the oxygen, he mm-hmm. wanted to take that risk if it kept me alive, but then they, you know, later told him, of course, that I would be... they felt that I would be a vegetable.
But once the days of the incubator were over, you just started growing and were a healthy baby.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Yeah, that's good. I was a couple months premature. I don't think they ever told my parents I wouldn't make it, but... Mm-hmm. Like I said, we were talking a while ago, I was born in St. Louis, and I figured the incubator I was in was powered by RF from KMOX. That's what happened to me.
Right.
And so as a child, they let you be a child, they let you run into things, they let you be a normal kid,
yep,
or what?
They did. I was a student at Perkins School for the Blind. I'm the oldest, Phil, of seven. And
oh, yeah.
I was expected. My dad had this that he let everybody know. That there was no coddling as old as son. I was going to, yes, I'd be going to Perkins, and yes, there was a concern about, hey, what's out there? And what he used to do, Phil, in his practice, he used to, and in medical school, he would seek out blind adults and find out what they did and how they did it. And he used to tell me many times, well, I saw this fellow named so-and-so, and he's going to medical school to be a psychiatrist. I think my dad wanted me to go into some form of maybe teaching medicine.
Uh-huh.
I was not interested in that. All I knew is I wanted to go into broadcasting.
But he took a great interest in your blindness and how you were going to be able to make it as a blind person.
Now that's correct. He did. And he also wanted me to be an example to my younger siblings, a good example they could look up to.
Yeah.
My biological mom unfortunately died in 1954, about a month after my 10th birthday. My dad had since remarried to one of the most wonderful, positive ladies in the world, Enid White, W-H-Y-T-E.
Uh-huh.
That's a Scottish spelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to meet her grandmother, who then automatically became my great-grandmother. She was a lot of fun. But she is, as I say, was very, very positive. We were a whole family again. So I had a brother and a sister by my, you know, we had a brother and sister, my first mom, and four others came along after.
That were birthed by both of your stepmother and your father.
That's correct. Although we don't call each other half or whatever. In fact, my youngest brothers are twins. It's quite an age range film in my family. At age of 11, the youngest, Andrew and John, Andrew walked up to me one night, and he said to me, you know, our sister told us that, you know, we were half-brothers and so forth and so on. Well, as far as we're concerned, you're no half-brother. You're just as much full brother as if you were born from the same mom.
So good, positive family, really.
Yes, very good. We've always had our scrapes and our little like everywhere else, but still, you know, I'm proud to say that now they claim that I'm an influence on them, though I wonder sometimes. My three youngest, my sister Anne was the first child by my new mom. I always like to call her my other mom.
Other mom, yeah.
Yep, and then came my brother Ned, who's an attorney for an oil company in the Persian Gulf. And then there's my brother John, who's an attorney, and his twin brother Drew, who is a physician. So they claim that all three of them claim I was a very good influence. But I think they did a lot of it on their own, and of course the positive influence from my mother, their biological mom, and my dad. So I think we've been, you know, pretty positive, you know. Family.
Lots of college-educated folks there.
This is correct, yes.
And so, but you alluded to the fact that you, as many of us did, became enthralled with broadcasting, radio as a youngster. And, of course, radio was a different thing than it is now.
It was. In fact, my dad, if he's up in heaven listening, he's probably grumbling, why the heck did I get him a radio?
Yeah.
We visited, one of my childhood heroes is a man named James Dudley Asher. He was a native of Lawrence, Kansas, and he moved to Massachusetts, and he started a little radio station in Quincy, which is called the City of Presidents, because John Adams and John Quincy Adams were born there. And a little bit of a sad note, though, and I want to allude to this. For a number of years, Mr. Asher, it was your community-based station, and they always had programs for everybody, and believe this or not, they also had programs for blind persons.
Really?
What
form did they take?
Well, these were, in the 50s, there were syndicated programs from, I believe, the American Foundation for the Blind, don't quote me, but they were information programs. I remember, Phil, listening to one on WJDA, which the station took the initials of Mr. Asher, and it was about it was about a blind couple, husband and wife. And Phil, I sat there and fascinated, enthralled, and I thought, my God, that could be me someday.
Yeah.
Well, that never was to be. I never married, and I don't hold any. You know, life and a lot of things could be worse. I would have liked to have been married, but it just wasn't to be, I guess. But JDA had, as I said, all these informational programs. They've treated all the organizations of and agencies for the blind as not sensationalist or, you know, like any demonstrations or heart-throbbing, heart-tugging things, but as we were just as much an economic part of the community as anyone else. I had to say, I mentioned before we went on the air a very sad note, and it's funny you should be calling now, and it's sadly ironic. Mr. Asher died in 1973. He was a horrible smoker, and he had been ill. His son took over the station. Believe this or not, as of tonight, his son has sold the station, and new owners are taking over.
Yeah, it's no longer an Asher owned radio station.
It's no longer an Asher owned radio station. And I mentioned this, as I say, I was talking with one of the employees who was there a number of years this morning, and I was reminiscing about a lot of things, and I'm not going to go into too many details because it is a local thing that wouldn't interest a lot of people around the country. But I told him the story about the programs for the blind and the way that the news of I can remember one local newscast where they interviewed the director of Perkins on funding for the Perkins Library.
Really?
Yes.
None of these people were had any eye problems.
None.
That's amazing.
Jay, that's why, as I say, Mr. Asher, Jay's father, of course his name is Jay Asher, Jay's father, Phil, really had a belief that everybody should be served, that no segment of the community would ever left out, and that included the blind. I remember there was a summer camp in this little town of Scituate, which is a seaside town south of Boston, and there was a summer camp for blind persons, which since has gone out of existence. But back in the 50s, they would arrange a trip on Thursday afternoons where some of the people would go actually into WJDA and do a program, like a music program.
Mm-hmm.
Some would play the piano and some would sing. And they did that for, I think, a couple of summers. But this is what the Asher family, they felt that everybody in the community deserved to be served, and no segment of the population was left out. And you never saw this in a lot of other communities, so-called community-based stations in other cities.
But
in Quincy.
But we were a lot more community-based radio back then.
Yeah.
I assume this was an AM.
It was AM. It was sunrise to no. It was 6 a.m. to sunset for a number of years, and then it went 24 hours about 12 years ago.
Yeah, but it doesn't serve the full market of Boston, so it's a marginal radio station now.
Well, but you wouldn't believe that, you know, there were people who actually did serve and did listen in Boston.
Sure, I'm sure
there
were.
I'm going to let that go to voicemail. But
Is that what that was? You get another call?
Yeah.
They'll call back.
Yeah. But anyway, but people in Boston would listen because their transmitters, there's a lot of grounding because of the wiring underneath the ground almost at sea level.
Yeah.
And so it belted out one heck of a good signal in the daytime. So people from and people who would comment, oh God, this is just like home, you know, if they lived in other states where there was community-based radio. That's the attraction that WJDA had.
Well, it's amazing to me that you, or did you ever work there? Did you ever go?
No, but I visited a number of times, and I got to know some of the people over the years. And in fact, I remember my last visit to the station, which was 3 years ago. I met the owner's son, and he was going to just give me a tour of the building for about 45 minutes. Well, when I started talking about his father, which was very heartfelt and very true,
mm-hmm.
the visit ended up to being a 3-hour visit. And I sat with a lot of the staff, and we had coffee together, and we chatted about things, and they even let me play with some of the equipment, and I accidentally knocked a commercial off the air. And
oh, yeah.
That was one of the funnier. But the owner told the program director, look, it's okay. I told him to press any button he wanted to. So it was kind of a fun day for me.
So you stopped the cart machine.
I did.
But I'm just surprised that you didn't fall into the trap that many of us did and say, well, you know, I'd like to work there, and I'd like to be a disc jockey, and so I'll go over there and to hell with college and everything else, and I want to play radio.
Well, Phil, the problem was this. As you know, radio is a very exacting business. I don't care if it's today or 50 years ago. You either go about it right or you don't go about it at all. And one of the things that I did not do, I thought writing to people at different stations and saying, well, blind people, you know, can they be in broadcasting would be enough. No, you have to go, as many will tell you, you have to go and you need to know what they're doing, what it's really like, volunteer, and then if this is something you want to do, then that's what you got to do. And you need to network in, which I did not do. I ended up as a teacher. I was a teacher in public school just briefly. But then I went and I tried to become a computer programmer. But
right. Before we get to all that, let's take just a short break and get you through Perkins and out of high school and into to what you thought you wanted to be. You're listening to Blind Like Me. Richard Chapman is our guest. We'll be back in just a second.
A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
Are you a person who loves to cook and loves to use all different types of spices? And I don't mean just salt and pepper, but I mean some really special spices that are maybe hard to find. Well, you should take a look at The Spice House at www.thespicehouse.com. Dale Campbell has recommended this site on his Cooking in the Dark program, and it's a great site for finding common spices or not-so-common spices. We recently bought some Caribbean seasoning that was just delicious, and the site's very easy to navigate. They actually tell you about a lot of the spices and how they create them and how they find them, which is very interesting. You can get books on spices if you want to. You can get pepper mills and things like that. And it's really a great site if you're into spices. I would give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. And the website again is www.thespicehouse.com. For Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights.
Guest is Richard Chapman. We're back. We have him going to Perkins, the Perkins School for the Blind. He has admitted his passion for radio, wonderful old radio that many of us love so much. Nice story about your friend that owned that radio station. And today, as of today, it will no longer be an Asher-owned station.
That's correct.
One of the big networks by Clear Channel or somebody?
No, it was a small... It was a... A multicultural group that owns stations in Connecticut. It's out of New York City, and they're buying the station. Apparently, they're going to be kind of eventually bringing in all their programs, but I think they're going to do satellite music for a while.
Korean or Japanese or something?
Something like that, or Spanish, a little bit of Spanish.
That's what AM is, and it's just an AM. They never did have an FM.
Never did.
They're... I don't know what's going to become of AM radio. I don't.
Well, a lot of people said within the next 5 or 10 years, people I've talked to said it just won't exist the way we know it. And it's just the opportunities and the work just isn't there.
Yeah.
And the listeners aren't there either. We're an aging demographics with AM. And you don't hear the 20s and 30 people, 20-something and 30-something who are in the business.
No, and the only way to make it is an AM station is a big one. The big ones in the major markets, 50 kilowatt,
yep.
They are still can do news talk and eke out too. But little there, I can name you 6 or 8 stations in my area that are just no longer on the air because
there's
little AMs. There's no way for them to.
That's correct.
To make money, that's such a shame. I was so in love with AM. I've gotten over it, but anyway. So you graduated Perkins School for the Blind.
Yes, and I went to a small college in Springfield, Massachusetts called American International College. And by the time I entered college in 1965, I had decided to be a Spanish major. So instead of getting involved with the school radio station, which I was almost tempted to do, I felt that since I was going into teaching, I needed to get involved with the Spanish club. And so I did. We had a club for 3 years. I visited schools in the Springfield, Massachusetts area, in the western part of the state. And I visited a lot of, you know, other schools. And then in 1969, when I graduated, I did my master's in Spanish from Syracuse University. After that, I did teach, well, I was practice taught in the town of Milton, and then lived out in Amherst, where I took courses at UMass for a while and tutored. Then I came back and taught a little bit from about 74 to 78, or 79, actually. And then I decided where it was hard to get into teaching. I thought, you know, I went to become a computer programmer.
But your degree was in Spanish. Was in teaching.
Well, it was Spanish literature, but in undergraduate, a minor in secondary ed, and it was just Spanish literature as a graduate.
And got that teaching certificate.
Yes, I did.
And actually went and taught in a public school.
Briefly, but I was not hired. You know, it was off and on. And they had a program which I jumped at the opportunity, I'm proud to say, of when I first heard about it. I went to one of our federal buildings in Boston. It was called the CETA program. And I said, hey, I'm interested, and I want to do something with CETA, with teaching. And so I did. And at the end of that, it was just stop and go. The last year of teaching, I was a long-term substitute. That had its problems, I'm afraid. And, of course, with applying to teaching jobs, more rejections, I'm afraid, than anything else.
Yeah, and you were obviously teaching high school students. And did you find some penchant for maybe taking advantage of you because you couldn't see as a teacher? Did you?
I also, there was a way that, I did, but I also found out later on from some of the teachers that the very same students that took advantage of me as a blind teacher also took advantage of the other teachers.
Yeah.
I was the only blind person in the school system. But the way I got from another teacher who's himself is out of teaching, way we got around that was that he said, never sit down when you're in a classroom. Always walk around. And it makes them nervous. They know you can't see them, but they're less tempted to cheat. The other thing that I learned is, my mom read to me an article, and don't remember who wrote it, but there was an article about, you know, from someone who was blind, and he made a comment, Phil, which I always, in my work with the Mass Commission for the Blind as a consumer advocate, I always tell people that when you go job hunting, and this is from what my mom read to me, go in there knowing how you're going to do the job. Because you could get the nicest courtesy interview in the world, but you're not going to get the job unless somehow you get a finger on the pulse of how the interview is going and learn when to insert it. And that way they have a good idea of, you know, hey, this is how he's going to do the job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, you're saying take the measure of the interviewer. That's what this is all about. In other words, you should figure out what the interviewer wants to hear and say it. And,
That's correct.
Well, yeah, duh, yeah, sure, you should.
That's right. Yeah.
And
sometimes you don't think about things like this, you know, when you go in an interview. In all fairness, I didn't in the beginning, and but you do need to know. You know, how, you know, what's out there for you, how you can use it, and that you're responsible for getting. You don't throw roadblocks in your way if you really want to, you know, want the job at a certain place.
I would think a totally blind person teaching high school kids would be pretty difficult. would be a pretty difficult thing to I think a sighted person teaching high school kids would be pretty difficult. Much
less
say,
it's the complexion of teaching regretfully has changed. I'm just dismayed sometimes, Phil, that you hear the number of people have cell phones in the classroom. And
they shouldn't be. They shouldn't,
that shouldn't be. Exactly.
They ought to have to put their cell phones in a pile up front somewhere and not to, my God, they would never have put up with that when I was going to school.
And neither they when I was in school.
And you think kids actually talk on their cell phone in class.
I've heard of that, those instances.
Yeah, we've let our education system in this, our education in this country go to in a handbasket, haven't we?
We have, but I think hopefully it's coming around with, you know, we have like the, these achievement exams, like the MCAS up here in Massachusetts. I don't know what you have in Texas, but they have the same in California. I have a friend who lives in who's blind, who lives in Menlo Park area of California.
That is teaching in public school?
No, but her daughter is a student. Well, her daughter, unfortunately, like her dad, did develop type 1 diabetes.
Mm.
Her dad has since passed on. But as I say, she's in the midst of taking all these exams, these standardized tests, and everything else that they have now. And hopefully things are going to, I don't know how things are going to turn around.
I don't either, but we need something. All right, so you did this 4 years of teaching. You decided that wasn't for you, so you decided you would become a computer programmer.
That's correct.
And I think you stated that you weren't very good at it.
No, I wasn't, and I ended up disliking it. I first of all went to a school in East Hartford, Connecticut, because their listings came back in Braille. And I don't have a good logical mind, Phil, and I think that's really the part of the, you know, that was part of the problem.
You don't have a good logical mind?
I don't.
You could have fooled me.
Well, I don't. I think as far as programming logic. Well, I was recruited by a company in Columbia, South Carolina, and I went down there for about 4.5 years, from 1982 through late 1986. And I came back up. I tried to get into jobs at teaching again. I did teach briefly at a junior college at the South Carolina Technical College system. And although it was in high school, these were kids that weren't exactly ready, as you might say, to break the high school experience.
Yeah.
But they did want to, in the University of South Carolina, they did want people to have a language, so I taught Spanish.
Well, but then in college, kids are there because they not because they have to be, but because they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they learn, fine. If they don't, that's not anyone's
that's
problem
correct.
But theirs.
You but, know? We did have a good, it was only part-time, and it went from semester to semester. You never knew. But I did have a lot of kids. Some of them were, you know, from very strict Southern families, and some of them just, I remember one guy said to me, they wrote evaluations of teachers, and I've always tried to be, as a teacher, very thorough. One man wrote, I think this is one of my favorite critiques. Quote, "Mr. Chapman, you were very hard, but you were very fair."
I like it.
I do too, and I showed that to my dad, and he said he was pleased. He really was very pleased.
Your dad has passed on.
He has, since he died in 1993.
Okay, so you taught at this junior college for a while, but you didn't like that, or they didn't like you?
There was no guarantee that it was going to be permanent. So there was nothing coming up on the job market in South Carolina, so I moved back to the Boston area in late 1986.
Yeah.
1987, I'm very proud of this, I took a part-time job, was only 2 days a week, at one of the nation's oldest high schools, Boston Latin.
Uh-huh.
And I was a lab technician. I ran the Spanish lab and the language lab, rather. And I also, since one of my friends worked there, I also earned a little extra money tutoring. Well, that wasn't going to last forever.
Uh-huh.
And I remember the day I got it. And I approached my mom and said, "Mom, I got good news and bad news." And she said, "What's the good news?" "I have this part-time job. It's, you know, at Boston Latin." And I said, "The bad news, it's only 2 days a week, and it's not permanent." Well, my mother said something, shows you how positive a lady she is. And she turned and said to me, "Rick, at least you got it yourself."
Well, yeah.
And that made me feel good. It really did, and I enjoyed that experience. Also.
And if you had wanted to stay there, it could have become permanent and full-time. No.
It was just, again, a year-to-year thing. So I started, you know, networking in with people at the Commission for the Blind. And finally, when this was in the era when Charles Crawford was commissioner, and I was brought on in August of 1987, in what they called an employment demonstration in their medical assistance program. They were beginning to have an influx of all kinds of computers and stuff. And so I started with medical assistance. I became a state employee in 1989, and I was in medical assistance until 2003, when they put me in the Office of Information Services as a consumer advocate.
Medical assistance, now explain that. I'm kind of lost there. Okay, so you administrated that, you...
Well, what I did, it was like any agency, the grand and glorious paper trail.
Yeah.
I was in charge of what they called the nursing, nursing home program. And this was that under the Medicaid program, blind persons who entered nursing homes, either short-term or long-term.
Okay.
And I had to process a lot of these things and give them to another person who entered them into the big Medicaid system.
So they look at them differently because they're blind?
Well, they do and they shouldn't, because it's the same rules and regs, even though it's been the Commission for the Blind, same rules and regs as anywhere else. But they do look at them as differently. You know, what do we do that's different? And I would tell many nursing homes, no, you don't do anything that's different.
No, you don't. I don't understand why they would not single them out, but why they would differentiate between blind people going into a nursing home and sighted people.
That's true. I don't understand it, and it just was one of these things that...
You worked at it for 20 years, and you don't understand.
Actually, I did it from 89... Well, yeah, that's right, almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years. That's a good long time. And you don't understand it, so I don't think we're going to here in our little one-hour...
There you go.
...radio show. I wouldn't. But you became a state employee, and that's the important thing. Because becoming a state employee means that you start contributing to the state retirement system, and you'll get your state pension, and you get holidays, many paid holidays, and vacations, and government jobs are the thing for a blind fellow to have, or anybody to have.
Well, I'm still full time, and I think like anywhere else, it has its ups and downs. But I remember the first week, and I have to tell you this story. One of my friends, whom I hope is listening, is ACB member at large, lives in Medford. And I was telling her, I hope she's going to be listening, but I worked with her. She did medical transportation. In other words, you know, Medicaid would pay for trips to and from doctor's offices and nothing else.
Yeah.
But she and I were working together, and I remember at the end of my first week that I was there back in 87, one of my co-workers, who's since left and gone to another state agency, we were making conversation at the end of the first week, and she goes, "Well, Richard, how did you enjoy your first week?" And I said to her, I'll just give her first name, Maria. I said, "Maria, there's one thing that I want to let you know. If you come in, if I were hiring somebody to do my job, Medicaid rules and regs are always changing wherever you are. But if you are hired and if you learn to have an appreciation of the health that you have, if you're lucky to be healthy, then I would consider you as knowing your job very well." Phil, I still feel that way. I've seen too many of my friends, blind or not, who have died prematurely and shouldn't have died. Like anyone else, you have your midlife crisis, but I tell people now, with every year, I say I'm 61 or I'm 62, and I'm proud of it. And this, I feel that way because I know I'm not going to get any younger. Nobody is. But I'm lucky to be well and lucky to be alive.
I pointed out to my doctor that I had bought a treadmill, and he said, Mr. Parr, writing the check for that treadmill was not nearly enough exercise for you, that you actually need to get on it. And he's right. And use it. And I do some, not nearly enough, but I do have one. And so your health is good, but you never married.
Nope.
And
I don't, and I don't want, it's why cry over the one that might have been or that wasn't.
Well, it still could happen. Probably won't, but it could.
Yeah, well, that's true.
One never knows. Do one, as they say in radio.
That's right.
But I tell you what, let's take a short break, and we want to come back and maybe get into some other, because I'm sure you have other interests other than radio and things like that. You're listening to Blind Like Me. Our guest is Richard Chapman. I'm Phil Parn. We'll be right back in just a sec. I'm Phil Parr, Richard Chapman from, you told me, close to Boston. What's the name of your town?
Actually, it's right in the city of Boston, and it's a section of Boston called Jamaica Plains.
Jamaica Plains. Heard about it in a Kingston Trio song.
Oh, yeah, that's right, the Charlie and the MTA.
Charlie and the MTA, and I've got a good friend that plays in the Boston Symphony Orchestra.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And he said they play that song quite often.
Yeah, and that's one of my other interests. I enjoy classical music.
Is that right?
Yes.
And you don't play anything?
I do not.
You do not? You just like classical music?
I just love it.
Well, this gentleman's name is Will Hudgens, and he is a percussionist.
His name sounds very familiar. I have heard of that.
He is
name.
A percussionist. He happens to be from Lufkin, Texas. His father was president of our college, Little Angelina College down here, and he went to, didn't go to Juilliard. He went to the other famous one. I can't remember what it is. And got a degree in music and got a job, got an appointment or whatever you would call it, got a seat on the Boston Symphony, goes to goes everywhere with him. Just came back from California. I can't remember the big retreat that they do every year.
Sure.
He goes on that and comes back to Lufkin and actually sits down and plays with the likes of me.
Ah.
While he's in town, I've got a little set of vibes that I acquired from a guy, a little set called Pit Vibes, a little 3/4 set. And he plays those and just blows and goes. I mean, just as fast as his hands amaze me.
Sure.
4 mallets and just working out on those vibes.
Right.
Anyway, you're classical music, you love that, so you go to concerts every chance you get, I guess.
Every so often I can. I also, with a good friend, I like to go to plays. We belong to a little group as members that it's a little theater in Waltham, Massachusetts, which historically is called the Watch City. They used to make the old Waltham watches. It's a little west of Boston, and it's a small group that has been around since 1936, and we go to plays every so often. They're not audio described, but we still go, and she's not blind, but nevertheless. And I also enjoy, I should read more than I do, and I'm shamefully, I don't. I love to exercise, and mention the treadmill in the building where I live, so I love doing that. I've always liked running, and I've been a member of the 2-mile team at Perkins where they paired you off with someone who had equal ability and a bit more sight than
and
you.
Some vision to keep you straight and
exactly
keep you...
So I enjoy running. I also am an incurable Harvard football fan, and another friend of mine, a graduate from Perkins, has some vision, works for the Harvard Club. the Harvard Club being for alums of Harvard.
Yeah.
So we go to the men's hockey games and football games together when we can. I guess what's, you know, as I said, what other interests do I enjoy? I still get fascination, maybe it's because my love of radio and how the skip improves, how the reception for distant stations improves at night. I'm fascinated, believe it or not, with sunrises and sunsets. I'm still in awe of them. I always have been.
Of sunrises and sunsets?
Yes.
Now, does this tie to your radio, to your listening to radio stations come on and go off?
It did when I was younger. But I think now it's just the way nature runs, how you can be allotted. I mean, you can move the clock backwards and forwards and sideways, too, as much as you want.
Yeah.
But you're still, no matter what part of the country, you're still going to get the same allotted amount of daylight.
Yeah.
No matter what it is. But that's fascinating.
Regardless of what time they say it is, that the cycle of the sun does not change.
That's right. And yeah, that fascinates me.
That's one thing we thought about. Remember in the millennium when we changed centuries and everybody, yeah, there were so many religious, so-called religious persons thought this may be the end of time. Did they really think God would come at some man-made time?
It doesn't make any sense to me. I listen politely, but that's just about it.
Yeah, do they think God knows it's 9:30 in Lufkin, Texas, and he's gonna come at some time that man designated? You know,
sure.
That didn't make any. Never made any sense to me.
Any sense to me either. But again, as I say, I just listen respectfully, and that's it.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, but like you're talking about radio, that's one of the things I miss is a radio station signing on and off. You don't hear that anymore.
No, you don't.
I don't know why I like to hear that, but I like to hear the guy, good morning. This is, you know, do the little sign on and talk
well,
about.
Well, Mr. Asher, getting back to JDA, the man, the founder, Jim Asher, used to do that every morning, and he did the morning show as well. So he was an interesting man.
Signed, he'd put his carrier on. You could hear the carrier, and you could hear him queuing up things in the background.
Yep.
You could hear him bring up a turntable, and it'd be a little little hum that you could hear. Those days are gone. Those days of radio. Everybody's on 24 hours a day. All right, sir. Well, we're going to let you go. And, one more thing. I would think you talked about your interest in theater. I would think with your command of the English language and I would think that you would be good as an actor.
I should have joined the drama club in high school, but I didn't. That's one of the mysteries of, you know, because when I used to read a lot, and I used, you know, in high school, more than I do now, shamefully to admit again, I used to pretend that what I was reading was being carried on the radio.
Sure, we all did.
Yeah. And so I used to read a lot of Shakespeare, and, you know, for that reason. But I've, you know, enjoyed, as I say, we in my family, my parents have always told us to take as many interests as you can. Get interest in as many things as you can.
Yeah, so you would read Shakespeare in those stentorian tones of... an announcer,
There you go.
You mentioned a while ago, Waltham Watch? What's the watch that you mentioned a while ago?
The Waltham City, where the watches were made, where the Hovey, the name of the group is called Hovey Players, H-U-V-V-E-Y, I think.
Mm.
But they've been around since 1936.
But you remember Longine Whitnor presents...
Yeah.
Those great symphonies.
It was.
Oh, they were. They were wanting new live classical music, so you enjoyed all that.
I did indeed.
You did. All right, sir. Maybe you'll get to meet my friend Will Hudgens someday. We're going to come to Boston and visit Tim and Cheryl one of these days, and maybe we can all get together.
I hope so.
We're going to come in the summer. I can tell you that.
Oh, listen, let me know, and I'd love to get a chance to meet you.
Well, we've interviewed several folks in the Boston area through Tim Cummings. He supplies us with names of people that he knows, and that's where we got your name. And your life, whether you're married or not, seems to have gone well, and you seem to have lots of interest, and are living it fully.
Be it by the grace of God, I hope it continues as such.